Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager. Today is Memorial Day in the United States, where I live and many of you listening do also. For this Memorial Day, our nation's president, whose odd name is Barack Obama, told us on his Saturday radio message to honor members of the military who made the ultimate sacrifice on behalf of their country. Yet he himself is not troubling to leave his Chicago hometown where he's spending the weekend to go to Arlington National Cemetery, as it's traditional for American presidents. He's sending his Vice President Joe Biden in his place. But what I really didn't like about his statement was the part about these service people giving their lives on behalf of their country. No. It was on behalf of the globalist power structure, bankers, and industrialists. How has what they've done benefited the people of this country? As Marine General Smedley Butler said, war is a racket. To my way of thinking, Obama was lying when he said our soldiers gave their lives for the benefit of the people of this country. Obama, though, lies all the time. It's become the American way. That's because, in my opinion, the American way has become the Jewish way. I have come to believe he is indeed the United States' first Jewish president. We thought he was the first black one. That was bad enough. But he's actually the first fully Jewish one. I realized that when I read that he and Michelle were hosting the first ever White House reception marking Jewish Heritage Month last Thursday. This is the entire month of May, so today is the last day of it. But this big reception is on top of the now also annual Seder dinner, which marks Passover, that the Obamas started 2 years ago with their Jewish staff. The Obama children attend too and take part in the ritual, asking the questions and so forth. I saw a very big, clear color picture of it in the New York Times a couple months ago when it was taking place, and it showed the Prez wearing a little skull cap like all the other Jewish men as they all sit under the White House chandeliers being served a kosher approved menu by elegant staff in the dining room of the People's Mansion. A third annual event, third, is the big Hanukkah party for which the White House kitchen has to be koshered, that is, undergo a special cleansing, even the entire kitchen, in order to serve totally kosher food to hundreds of people. God forbid these superstitious Jews should eat non-kosher food like the rest of us, though I'm sure most of them do it all the time. It was George W. Bush, our partly Jewish president, who first declared Jewish Heritage Month in 2006. So now that it's 4 years old, I suppose they thought they could push things a little further and have a big White House reception to mark it. I think it's to show how nicely they fit there, to get us used to seeing them there en masse. What I'm leading into here is that one of Obama's favorite Jews, well, his favorite, one of his favorite people, I think, is Elie Wiesel. He had Elie over for a special kosher lunch at the White House recently. Do you really think Elie Wiesel turns down food if it isn't kosher all the time? I don't. But I think these two are friends because they are both lying imposters whose identity is in question. It's quite true that like attracts like. The main thing as Jews that they have in common is their natural ability to lie, their comfortableness with lying. And it seems the bigger the better. So my second revelation from all these Jewish parties in the White House is that the United States of America is a Jewish country. I mean this sincerely. It's not just Judaize, as I thought before. It's Jewish through and through. And it has been for a long time. It's just now coming out fully into the open. It has been maybe even from the very beginning. At least we know that there were Jews here from the very beginning. And they were effective and powerful. So this is a rather awful thought, but it explains a lot to me. I'm going to have to leave it at this for now, and I want to talk about Elie Wiesel just a little bit. Today is the day of the big benefit forum and dinner in Toronto, Canada, featuring Elie and Sir Salman Rushdie, that I have been hoping some Torontoans would show up at with signs demonstrating against Elie. In fact, it's probably still taking place right now as I speak, but coming to an end. This is a major yearly event called Friends of Hope Benefit Dinner that benefits the Simon Wiesenthal Center for Holocaust Studies. Holocaust studies, like war, the Holocaust is a racket. It came out of war. Does all this money, and it's up to, this benefit was up to $3,600 per ticket, go to help needy people in any way? No. It's very much like a political party. It's special interests. The money goes to Holocaust pushers and lawyers and legal fees for the Lying Wiesenthal Center, which says it uses it to promote, get this, justice, tolerance, and freedom of speech. Yes, those are the words they use. What a lie. What a big, fat lie. Could these people lie any more than they do? It doesn't seem possible, but they could probably find a way. It occurs to me that the Jews are so self-engrossed they select Memorial Day in the United States, which means nothing to them. They're not interested in participating in it because it's not about them, to hold in Canada their biggest benefit of the year. Think about that. Wiesel is an American citizen. The late Simon Wiesenthal was an American citizen. Most of the Simon Wiesenthal Center's employees and operators probably are. It's based in California, though it's worldwide. They benefited extraordinarily. All these people benefited extraordinarily from living here. But on Memorial Day, they hightail it up to Canada to suck up all the Canadian Jewish money they can. Well, one reason we might offer for why Jews are like they are is given in the latest issue of the Barnes Review. In the May-June issue, 2010, it's entirely devoted to the theme of the revenge of the Neanderthals. While the Barnes Review has been at work on this issue for quite a while, new science reports of studies have come out during that time detailing that Neanderthal genes are in fact found in modern humans, even today. And guess what? The most likely candidates for the most Neanderthal genes are the Jews. Now, I know at first glance this seems too far out and wildly anti-Semitic, but you have to take the time to read and study the evidence. The cover article by Willis Carto is very well done. It's a fairly long but reader-friendly introduction to the subject, which reveals immediately that they are not just going after the Jews, but there is solid science behind this. Also in the magazine is an article by anthropologist Michael Bradley, who has been studying the Neanderthal-Jewish connection for many years, and some excerpts of his work. And he is part Jewish himself. That always helps in the mass mind out there. Michael Collins Piper, who edited the magazine, had Michael Bradley on his radio program last week for two nights, and I tuned in, and Bradley said some things that really stood out for me, and I want to go over some of these things now. So to begin my little lesson here, and I am not a scientist, of course you all know that, but the later Neanderthals were centered in the Caucasus Mountains. Now the Caucasus Mountains are to the east of the Black Sea and not that far from the Middle East and then Ukraine to the north. So there was some interbreeding with early modern man and therefore later man also. They moved out of the Caucasus both to the south and north of the Black Sea with the greater number heading south and becoming a presence in the Middle East. In the north, they can be considered to be the Khazars. In 1978, the world expert on Neanderthals and a Smithsonian director wrote an article. I'm not sure if that is the same person or two different people. But anyway, the article is Hard Times Among the Neanderthals. This was in 78. And in it, they described how forensic analysis of Neanderthal bones showed twice as many injuries as any other group of bones from any other people, including Asians, Indians, Africans, all other people. This is interpreted in anthropology as meaning that the Neanderthals were more aggressive than anyone else. In fact, twice as aggressive. This same area nurtured the Homo habilis, probably, which is a pre-man, comes out of former East Africa. And these creatures were also found in the Northern Caucasus, especially in Georgia. The Neanderthals may be related to this Homo habilis because they have a similar jawbone, although the Neanderthal jaws are a little bit less pronounced than the Homo habilis, so they could be a later development of this pre-man. And also, I should tell you, I guess, that the Homo habilis, they have changed that name to Homo georgicus because it's found mostly in Georgia. But what does this mean? Well, it means that Neanderthals may not be quite human. I don't know if we've ever considered that Neanderthals were human. I think we haven't. But the people, I think it's saying that the genetic material in today's humans that is Neanderthal is not human genetic material. And it shows that that actual Neanderthal genetic material is twice as aggressive as us. Now, the physical traits that he talks about, now get this, include great nasal development, long torsos, short legs, extreme male hairiness. Also, culturally, they expressed extreme monotheism and intolerance for differences between races or sexes. This interests me very much. Bradley says that Asians have a tendency toward polytheism and a great deal of artistic visual ability and a tolerance of women in society. Well, we know that Europeans, before Christianity was imposed, were polytheistic and have always had great artistic ability and a tolerance of women in society. The more northern parts of Europe had the best acceptance of women as valuable partners rather than property. But the Khazars from the Caucasus were male-dominant, anti-feminine people who converted to Judaism rather than Christianity or Islam. They had their choice, supposedly. And so Michael Bradley says that we are fighting a genetic war in the Middle East. He says from 5600 BC to the present, this has been the world's problem. He has a pretty strong view on it. Now, a little more from what I got from that is, when the Mongols invaded Ukraine, the Mongols I'm talking about now, not the Neanderthals, they pushed the Khazars into Poland and eastern Germany, and these are the Jews of the Warsaw Ghetto and other ghettos. The Mongols didn't care very much about imposing a religion. They just wanted more room, temporarily. Later, when conditions improved there, where they had come from, they left and went back home. And he says they are not Neanderthals. That's not how Neanderthals behave. The first Neanderthal skull was actually found in the Neanderthal Valley in Germany in the 1850s. The last ice age that developed in the east caused migrations to Western Europe. Since the 1850s, more Neanderthal bones have been found all over Western Europe, but the vast majority in Germany, France, and the Middle East. But some also in the mountains of the Balkans. They were mountain people. Where are we now? Well, there's an article on Michael Bradley's website, which is www.michaelbradley.info, very easy to remember, where he says he wants to form a movement against what he calls this Neanderthal attack on all societies of the world. That's interesting. Now, from Michael Bradley's website, I'm going to quote, before 15th century European maritime expansion and commerce, the world's people, I think, is what he's trying to say here. Mostly inhabited at the Atlantic, Western Europe, most of Africa, perhaps Atlantis in the past, North and South America, and across the Pacific to the Far East, Japan, and China. And the world's people, he says, there are several geographic varieties, differentiated mostly by skin color and some other physical traits. But he says that this subspecies as a whole exhibits a clear tendency toward polytheism, a tolerance of females in society and in divine affairs, and a relatively low level of aggression. All varieties share a reasonable level of intelligence, very definite visual artistic ability, relatively non-protruding noses, and only moderate male hairiness. Also, a relatively low degree of behavioral differences between the sexes, which is dimorphism. Now, that's Michael Bradley's website. So now I want to tell you that Alan Hart, who is an ex-BBC journalist and has started to speak out against Israel, has said recently that there is nothing Zionists will not do to attain their ends. That is, the chances and risks they take beyond what people will believe they would have the nerve to do. But they do have the nerve, and this is what always amazes us, the rest of us. And is it because of their innate aggressiveness? Sure, it could very well be because they are somehow innerly pushed to this kind of behavior to just overcome or overwhelm their opponent. Just like on a small scale, I come back to Ali Wiesel, what the Wiesel has the nerve to do. With all the evidence about him coming out, still, even revisionists are having trouble believing or accepting that he would be able to calmly continue all these years to so boldly lie about his identity or about his whereabouts during this so-called Holocaust, because they can't comprehend anyone doing that. Well, I can now. I have come to be able to comprehend it, and just as Adolf Hitler was able to comprehend it and described it as the big lie. In that the bigger the lie, the more success it can have, because the little people cannot believe anyone would tell a lie so big or that they could get away with it. Then these big liars managed to make people believe that Hitler was talking about his own big lies, which he wasn't, as if he was so stupid that he would announce his secret weapon of lies to the world. Well, another big lie that I'm going to talk about tonight is the legend of the terror bombing of the poor little Spanish city of Guernica by the evil Nazis. This is one of those stories that, no matter how many times it has been shown to be false, the original misrepresentation, to give the lie a nicer name, sticks in people's minds, with a bit of help, of course. In 1937, an event occurred which is known today as Guernica. It was the supposed destruction by German airplanes of a Spanish Basque city of 5,000 to 6,000 people during the Spanish Civil War. It was called a terror attack on a civilian population and widely condemned and publicized. It is memorialized in a world-famous painting by a world-famous painter, the Spaniard Pablo Picasso. If you're not familiar with this painting, I'm going to put it on the program page. It's one of those huge mural-like artworks, but done in black and white, so that which is considered part of its uniqueness. And Picasso, by the way, was a professed communist who lived in France most of his life. These charges of a terror attack can be shown to be false, even to be intentional lies. As you might have noticed, lies and the various kinds of lies that we're dealing with is the real subject of my program tonight. But even though these lies can and have been shown to be false, they persist. For example, on Wikipedia's Bombing of Guernica page, you will read, and I quote from there, "The bombing of Guernica, April 26, 1937, was an aerial attack on the Basque town of Guernica, causing widespread destruction and civilian deaths during the Spanish Civil War. The raid by planes of the German Luftwaffe Condor Legion and the Italian fascist Aviazione Legionaria was called Operation Rügen." Rügen is a German word. The Basque, even though the German forces that had volunteered there were under the supervision and control of Franco and his forces. But anyway, the Basque government reported 1,654 people killed, but modern research suggests between 200 and 400 civilians died. Western countries viewed Guernica as an example of terror bombing and gained the impression that the Luftwaffe was committed to that tactic. The bombing was the subject of a famous anti-war painting by Pablo Picasso. That's the end of the Wikipedia quote. And notice that it says that the world gained the impression. Wonder how they gained that impression. We're going to see. You can read the rest of this page on Wikipedia if you want to, and you'll find that it is full of CRAP. I know I shouldn't talk like that, but it really gets to me. But I want to tell you that in 1974, Alfred Maurice de Zayas published new research into the Guernica bombing. What he wrote was written in German and appeared in the Weltforschung, the Journal of the Bundeswehr, in June of 1974. Dr. Wilhelm Christmann, who's been on my program quite a few times, has translated this article recently and sent it to me. Its English title is Guernica in Light of Latest Research. Alfred de Zayas, and today, by the way, is his birthday, is a Cuban-born American lawyer, researcher, author of many books, and former high-level UN official in the field of human rights. He has done excellent work examining the ethnic cleansing in the former Yugoslavia and the expulsion of ethnic Germans from Eastern Europe following World War II. Now, in his research paper, which is pretty long and highly documented or footnoted, he says that, and I'm going to take my information now from this, he says that Guernica has become almost a technical term for aerial terror against civilians. Nearly all historians repeat that the Germans bombarded this city intentionally in order to destroy it and to, quote, research the effects like a clinical test, unquote. Kind of like Dr. Mengele did his medical experiments. Since de Zayas knew how war propaganda works, he decided to go to the German archives and look for the orders given by the Legion Condor on April the 26, 1937. Unfortunately, nearly all documents of the German Luftwaffe have been destroyed after a heavy Allied air attack on Potsdam on the night of April the 14th, 1945. That's ironic, isn't it, that these records of the aerial bombing by the Legion Condor were destroyed by the bombing of the Allies. Anyway, some, however, have been saved, some of it, and so among them is an unpublished history of the Legion Condor from the year 1940. That document can still be found at the Bundesarchive, which is the Federal Military Archive in Freiburg, Germany. So, on page 47 of this manuscript, we read, quote, on April 26th, an air attack at the bridge and the street crossing hard eastward of Guernica was ordered. This is the German report. 9 aircraft attacked from an altitude of 2,300 meters by single-line approach. 9 250-kilogram and 150-kilogram bombs, a total of 7,950 kilograms, were dropped. The observed results were no hits at the bridge. In other words, they didn't observe with their normal eyesight any hits at the bridge. Then it goes on to say visibility was very poor because the city was wrapped by fire and smoke. Because of the bomb attack, the enemy press was able to blame the German squadron for the destruction of Guernica. Strong propaganda followed. The pilots received orders to spare the town, actually. It was rather the Reds who methodically turned it into ruins by blasting and setting it on fire. That was also the reason why the visibility for the flying formations was handicapped by the dense smoke of the already burning town, unquote. Well, folks, this is the end of the first half of the show. We're going to take a break now, and then we're going to continue on the topic of Guernica. So stay tuned, and I'll be right back.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
story now and get further reaction from America as we go live to New York, where I'm now joined by political scientist Norman Finkelstein. Mr. Finkelstein, many thanks for joining us. Now, we've had widespread condemnation in Europe so far at the actions of the Israeli Defense Force when they boarded the aid ship flotilla. But what has been the reaction over in America?
So far, there's been a pretty mild statement by President Obama regretting what happened, saying it should be investigated, but not going beyond that. I would call it a mild display of concern.
So just a mild display of concern then. But Jerusalem has said that it was just trying to protect its borders and its citizens, and that the flotilla was actually on a mission to discredit the state of Israel. What do you say to that?
I think there are many things that need to be said, and there has to be serious thought given to what's happened. Let's start from the basics. Israel was imposing an illegal blockade on Gaza, what was called by Amnesty International last week a flagrant violation of international law. The United Nations Committee of Elders, people like Nelson Mandela, Desmond Tutu, they just distributed a statement today in which they called the blockade of Gaza one of the worst human rights violations in the world today. Number two, Israel attacked a humanitarian convoy in international waters. They used armed commandos to attack an international, or I should say a humanitarian convoy in international waters. I think everyone can agree that there's no possibility, there's no way to justify using armed force against what were clearly unarmed humanitarians trying to relieve an illegal siege of Gaza. But to me, the more important question is this. Namely, during Israel's massacre in Gaza, December 2008 and January 2009, afterwards, Israeli officials were saying that they wanted to show the Arab world that they were capable of acting like a lunatic state and like mad dogs, that they wanted to restore the Arab world's fear of Israel. And that's why they acted like a lunatic state and like mad dogs in Gaza. But after yesterday's events, we really have to ask the question, is Israel acting like a lunatic state, or has it become a lunatic state? And that's not just a rhetoric. It's a very serious issue.
Well, Mr. Finkelstein, the UN is actually meeting
nuclear device.
It's true, and the UN is actually meeting today. It's held an emergency meeting to discuss the raid and its reaction to what Israel has done. So what sort of conclusions do you think that they will come to, and do you think their findings will make any kind of difference?
Well, I think the important issue is that what happened with the Gaza flotilla was not an accident. You have to remember that the Israeli cabinet met for fully a week. All the cabinet ministers discussed and deliberated how they would...
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm Carolyn Jaeger. I was telling you about the surviving document report of the Legion Condor history at the German Federal Archives in Freiburg, which described a bombing raid on the bridge east of Guernica and the road crossing. Now we'll look at what Dozias wrote about Goering, what Goering supposedly said. The historian Hugh Thomas in his highly praised and nearly official work, The Spanish Civil War, stated that Goering admitted in 1946 that Guernica served as a testing ground. However, the information comes from a rather dubious secondary source, the memoirs of the anti-Franco monarchist Antonio Ansaldo. Now, Ansaldo, in his book, Parquet, the question mark, published in 1950 in Buenos Aires, and which that makes me think of Weasel's book, Night, which was also published in Buenos Aires and for the first time in 1955. Well, Ansaldo wrote that shortly after the attack, he was in Guernica, and he believed at the time that the city was destroyed by arson. So, not an air attack. But later, he read about Goering's alleged confession in a French newspaper, so he changed his mind to what he read in the newspaper. Now, De Zayas did a little detective work and found this news story came from a news agency, CNA, this standing for the National Chinese Central News Agency of Taiwan. As you know, Nationalist China was a U.S. puppet at the time, and who knows who else is, but this CNA had an office in New York, and when contacted, they claimed that their agency did not announce such a report. So it was likely a planted story or just an irresponsible one. The 42 volumes of the International Military Tribunal in Nuremberg were found to not contain any hints of such statements by Goering. In Volume 9 of these records, the only Goering remark about the Legion Condor appears, and it is, quote, "The greater part of transport planes, as well as a trial unit of fighters, bombers, and flak, were sent to Spain to test material under warlike conditions." Remember, this was in 1937. Well, the quote ends with "under warlike conditions." So this was then twisted into using Guernica as a testing ground for terror bombing. But Goering's 1946 statement did not contain any information about Guernica or anything to suggest terror bombing. So if Goering would have said something like that, like they say he said, the correspondent and world press would have immediately jumped at such a sensation. But it should be noted that while some smaller newspapers carried this story, the New York Times never mentioned Goering's alleged confession in their newspaper. And research at the State Archive Nuremberg and the National Archives at Washington, D.C., into the extensive interrogation protocols of Goering, surrendered no statements made by Goering about Guernica. Nevertheless, this press rumor spread widely and is found not only in Ansaldo and Thomas's books, but also histories that are valuable in other respects, De Zayas says, such as those by historians John Killen, Vicente Talon, Pedro de Basaldres, and Alberto de Onenda. He is saying that these are books that are good books, but they carry this lie, nevertheless, about Goering, and suggesting that it was a planned terror attack. So now De Zayas decided, he's a very thoroughgoing researcher, and he decided to interview members of the Legion Condor. So he was able to get a hold of some of them, and he interviewed General, retired at that time, Adolf Galland, and Hermann Plocker and Gustav Rodel, all former members of Legion Condor, who all, however, arrived on the scene after the destruction of Guernica. But they all declared it was a limited attack on military targets that occurred. Because of bad visibility and weather conditions, which means, you know, not very good weather conditions, and primitive target devices used at that time, that is, they were not very good at targeting where the bombs were going to hit, non-military objects were also hit. But by no means, all three were unanimous on this. Was it a terror attack against the civilian population? But the most convincing report he has is from a pilot officer who took part in the Guernica mission, one who actually was piloting one of the planes, whom he personally interviewed, Colonel Hans Henning, or retired at that time, Hans Henning Freiherr von Burst. And von Burst remembered that as far as the attack order went, and I'm quoting from what De Zayas took from him now, it was an order for a mission against tactical and troop targets supporting their own ground forces, like most of our missions flown at that time by our KG-88 at the Bilbao front. No word of a terror trial attack. No talk about a mission against the town or against the civilian population. It has to be said that Guernica was occupied by strong enemy troops and movements from and to the front leading through the town. Still, the town was not our target, but the aforementioned bridge, as well as troop movements and fortifications of the enemy on streets and streets or which led to the bridge. Now, streets is used, it probably should be roads. In German, it's often called streets, but this is probably should be, it was roads and roads which led to the bridge, because it was not like city, in the city, city streets. The tactical, I'm still quoting now, the tactical idea of the attack was very clear: to destroy the rear connections of the enemy by an attack on its most vulnerable spot, unquote. Freiherr von Busse thought it possible that a number of bombs were dropped by error into the town, causing some damage. He vehemently challenged that his unit fired machine guns against civilians. Obviously, that was also charged. And that, of course, is what the Allied planes did in the German cities as they were bombing them. They were also firing machine guns when they got low enough and against civilians that were trying to run away and find some place to hide. So this is so typical where those in these kinds of oppositional battles, political battles and so on, those people like the communists, they always accuse the other side of doing the things that it's actually they themselves do. Now, von Busse is convinced that the Reds, maybe not the Basques, but members of the international brigades, perhaps, set the fires for the destruction of Guernica. So Desaix conducted another interview with Mr. Franz Welser, another German who was a radio operator at the Legion Condor from November 1936 to January 1938. He confirmed that he never heard anything about an order for air attacks. On the contrary, all orders were strict and quite plain. Cities have to be spared. There were, for instance, strict orders to spare churches by all means. Of course, this was a Franco operation, and he was supported by the Catholic Church, and naturally they were not wanting to bomb the churches. The Reds must have known about these orders. Of course, they did, because they warehoused ammunition in churches and blew them up when they were unable to remove it. This was another tactic of theirs that was pretty common. So on the day of the attack at Guernica, Franz Welser was in Victoria, and about a week later he was personally in Guernica. And he says, "I think it is impossible that the destruction was caused by bombs of the air attacks alone, but it was caused by infantry fights, artillery shells, or retreating troops also," he said. Mr. Weiser does not think Italian units' airplanes were involved, and that also has been pretty much disregarded, that there are any Italian planes. It was just these nine or so German Condor planes. It was not a huge bombing mission at all. Now, another big point is that Guernica was not an open town. Louis Boland quotes in his book Spain, the Vital Years, a report to General Franco's headquarters on that day of April 29, 1937, the day when Guernica was taken by Franco's forces. "The enemy showed resistance," this report went. This is a military report. Quote, "The enemy showed resistance. Our losses were 8 dead and 60 wounded. Guernica was defended by 8 Basque battalions and 2 battalions from Santander. We took some prisoners, wounded soldiers, and caused the enemy heavy losses, especially at the hills west of the town, where we captured large supply depots," unquote. So Guernica defended herself and cannot therefore be considered an open town at the time of the German air attack. Of course, an open town is one which is undefended, and therefore it is not considered okay to attack it in any way. Guernica also had military targets within her boundaries. At the time of the attack, the city was not only crowded with troops, but had a weapons factory located there, which was producing mortars, pistols, incendiary shells, and more. And it also had a railway station used for transporting troops and ammunition, which is another legitimate target. So even if the extent of the German air attack at Guernica remains questionable, that is, if we can't say for sure just how extensive it was, Desaix is saying, there is no doubt that an air attack would have been justified. at least regarding the bridge, the ammunition factory, and the railway station. Another question that arises is the numbers, the number of dead and wounded. Well, first, let me say that on April 26th, the Basque government ordered a partial evacuation of Guernica. The Basque government, they were fighting with the Reds. They were nationalists, but they were against the church and the clerics and Franco because they wanted to break away and have their own country. So therefore, they were also, that's why they were fighting. And this was a Basque town, of course. Remember that. So this was their area. And they had ordered, they were in charge of this town, and they had ordered a partial evacuation of Guernica on that day. Therefore, not many civilians were living in the city during the bombing attack, which was in the late afternoon and evening. Those who were there went to the bomb shelter, and therefore low losses were registered. The lowest number is based on a Spanish government commission, which would be Franco's commission, so you have to take that into consideration. It amounted to less than 100 people out of a population of 6,000. Now, there was a protest declaration against the bombing by well-known Americans. That's, he mentions, and doesn't say who these well-known Americans are, but I think you can imagine, I think he doesn't want to say that they were Jews. They talked about over 800 dead, a number also quoted by the New York Herald Tribune. Now, the highest figure was given by, actually, by the Basques, but it was mentioned by Hugh Thomas in that book I already spoke of, and it is 1,654 killed and 889 wounded. This was the highest figure that Desaias found anywhere. But this figure is now totally repudiated almost by everybody. But still, you'll see it passed around. And still, when Guernica is talked about, it's talked about as being a place where just terrible, terrible things happened to the civilians there in that bombing raid, you know, that they were targeted and so on. So people still keep these ideas like over 1,000 killed and so on, even though they're not factual. So the Spanish journalist, Desaias says, Vincent Talon writes in his book, Arde Guerra, published in Madrid in 1970, that a list of Guernica's civilian deaths with first and family names can be put together. And he said the number of dead then, according to that, is below 200. And that's the most likely figure. That's the one that is pretty widely accepted today in actual circles that know what they're talking about, but it is not necessarily what the general public believes. So again, Desaias is very thorough, and he decided to go to Guernica himself, finally, and interview the local people. He says he visited there in March 1972, and even though he couldn't speak Basque, he speaks Spanish, of course, and so he could talk to everyone. And he says that the result was that there were as many opinions as heads, or as many opinions as there were people. The older ones said that on April 26th, an air attack occurred. But about the nationality of the airplanes, they could not see anything certain because they were either outside the town or at bomb shelters. Many thought they were German planes. Others steadfastly said they were Italian. And some even mentioned that the aircraft were Rojos. That's the Reds, the communists. That's pretty funny. They must have been the anti-Rojo people who thought they were Rojo planes. Some referred to the time between 1900 o'clock, or that's at 7 p.m., when the planes turned away, and 2 days later, around 11 o'clock in the morning, when Franco's troops marched in, they said explosions continued during all that time. And many buildings, the church, San Juan included, I guess that's a well-known church, were apparently systematically blasted by dynamite or incinerated with gasoline. But he cannot say whether the majority of the population is of that opinion. That is, Desaias can't say, because he didn't talk to everyone. You know, he's very, very careful. He refuses to say anything that might be an exaggeration or take anything beyond what exactly he can find out for sure. But he says that the priest Don Jose Luis Albaonza, who fought on the side of the Basque, declared that he does not believe the Basque burned down their own city. Asked about the losses, he frankly answered the figure of 200 must be correct. So, and he says that the majority of the people who Desaias questioned agreed with that estimate of about around 200. So another priest also denied the possibility that the Basque militia set Guernica on fire, but I think these are Basque priests. And when you talk to the other Spanish priests or Italian, here we have Monsignor Gustavo Franceschi, who visited Guernica shortly after the attack. He stated, "The destructions which I saw during the last month in Spain taught me one has to differ between damages caused by airplanes, artillery, or fire. At Guernica, the fire was set by the Basque. I can prove it with my photos, but neither my evidence nor that of many others will prevent lies." Well, he must have been speaking about photographs he took, which showed the type of destruction that was there, and that it was definitely wasn't the kind of destruction that's caused by bombs from airplanes. Coming up a little bit, and throughout, which I haven't emphasized enough, is that many people said that, maybe not many, but some have said that there were no bomb craters in Guernica after it was all over. No bomb craters in the town, in the city. So, to continue, another cardinal from Toledo, Spaniard, wrote to the L'Observatore Romano, so a church paper, that he was in Guernica a few days after the destruction and found out that arson caused it. But, of course, most of the media, as well as the president of the Basque province, contradict this. So you see how it goes. It depends on what side you're on, how you want to witness what you saw. Regardless of the different opinions, there are sufficient proofs available. Now, this is Desaias kind of summing up here. He says, regardless of the different opinions, there are sufficient proofs available to support the thesis that Guernica was destroyed by the Rojos. The scorched earth policy was well known to be used by the Republicans, that's them. Franco's forces were the Nationalists, and the Communists and the International Brigade, etc., were the Republicans in this instance. So he says that they used the scorched earth policy regularly, and as proven by the nearby cities of Irún, Ibar, Durango, and Amorebieta. So, well, for your information, it's because Franco's forces were the Nationalists, that's why Hitler agreed to help them. He wasn't in total agreement with Franco's party there, but knowing that they were the Nationalists and they were fighting the Communists, he knew that he had to come to their aid, as he agreed with the Duce on that. So then we have, after this, we have military reports and diplomatic notes about Guernica. Now, you know, when you talk about military reports and they're supposed to be secret and not for publication. So they weren't meant to be, you know, put out to the public, and therefore there's no reason why they would try to disguise or correct the truth, why they wouldn't say just what was. So an excerpt from the report of the 6th Army Corps from April 28, 1937 states, this is Franco's corps, "Our troops continued our advance and reached a line stretching from eastward Navarrez Uarca, 2 kilometers east of Guernica, to Durango, which we could take against strong resistance. The enemy was supported by Russian tanks. Dense fog coming down from the mountains diminished the visibility quite a bit and prevented our advance to Guernica. Our soldiers tried hard to enter the city. They already knew that the enemy evacuated Guernica after they destroyed it criminally and blamed our airplanes for it. Guernica, however, is free of bomb craters." And from a report of the 4th Navarre Brigade, which is the unit that actually occupied the town, we read, "Numerous farmers and whole families returned to Guernica after they found out that the city was liberated. Shattering scenes were seen when they saw the destruction and plunder devastating their city." Well, it's also important to mention, this is very important, that the historical Casa de Juntas, which is the old Basque parliament, as well as the Arbol de Guernica, which is the old oak below which the parliament was in session, and nearby buildings remained intact. Now, it's very probable that all those buildings would have been destroyed if the Germans really would have so brutally bombed the city as it is said and commonly believed. But if it should really be true that the Basque destroyed their sacred city themselves, then they would for sure have spared the building and symbols of Basque freedom and honor. that's something that is rather compelling, in my opinion. So Desaias then concludes, and he says this, all in all, and I'm shortening this, but all in all, it is proven with certainty that German airplanes did attack on April 26, 1937, at least the near surroundings of Guernica. It is also obvious that at the time of the air attack, Guernica was not an open city. Therefore, it was legal to attack it. Furthermore, the proofs for the intentional destruction of the city by Basque Dimiteros, or more possibly Asturian miners or even members of the International Brigade, is not without convincing power. A figure of more than 200 dead cannot be reliably proven. From all these facts, which cannot be swept away, quite a different viewpoint of Guernica's destruction appears. The core of Guernica's myth was the accusation, which up to now has never been documented by historians, well, that's at the time he wrote this, that the Germans cynically bombed the unprotected civilian population in order to test their airplanes. That story sounded pretty good at that time and was favorably used as war propaganda, but 37 years after the destruction of Guernica, well, then it was 37 years, today is 72 years. The reader of historiography has the right to receive information that is beyond propaganda legends. At the same time, we have to go along, and this is a nice closing here, at the same time we have to go along with the experience that lies cannot be easily removed from the world. George Bernard Shaw remarked, as soon as a lie becomes popular, it is impossible to catch her. Even though she be refuted often and by very authoritarian people, ignorant men will repeat her again. Journalists will copy each other until it is no more fun to believe. Then, and not earlier, she dies of a natural death. It is, however, a very creeping death. It may well last 1.5 centuries, if I judge it by the lies discovered and refuted during my childhood and still enduring today at the end of my long life. That was George Bernard Shaw. Well, there we have it, ladies and gentlemen. I began with lies, and I end with lies. Lies, as I see it, are our biggest problem. I hope you will ponder the problem of lies. Until next week, this is Carolyn Yeager. Good night.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.